Welcome to Carson City. This is our first oral argument in the Supreme Court building this year, so we're happy to be here. I'm joined here today, of course, by my two colleagues, Judge Abby Silver to my right and Judge Jerome Tao to my left. We had two cases set for argument, but one of them went off with a counsel was unavailable. So that means you get extra time today. No, maybe. All right, so the one case we have on is 65854, Padilla Construction versus Burley. This is the time set for the argument. And we have Mr. Ferris, and also Mr. Grant. Okay, and Ms. Sagerblum?
Yes.
All right, and who's with you?
This is my partner, Dave Canepa, but I'm the argument.
Okay, all right, so Ms. Canepa, welcome to you too. All right, and we have a full courtroom today. I bet you had a full courtroom at one time in Reno. All right, so we will proceed. Mr. Ferris, are you going first?
Yes.
And would you like to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, we'd like to reserve 5 minutes, Ron.
All right, and what about Mr. Grant? When will he be speaking?
We're going to split this up 5 minutes to 5 minutes. So I'll be doing 5 minutes, and then he'll be doing 5 minutes. I'll be doing both the complaint and the verdict form. He'll be hitting the Arguello issues. So.
All right, thank you. Okay, we're ready to go, so you may proceed.
May it please the court?
Yes.
Okay. The first part of this appeal deals with an amended complaint. In this matter, an amended complaint was filed approximately 1 week before the trial started. This amended complaint was unique in that it wasn't just modifying a complaint to deal with facts that were found during discovery. This was an amended complaint that actually added a party and added causes of action. Based on the timelines involved, we filed a motion to strike. This motion to strike was heard fairly quickly, within days of the trial. We went into this motion to strike with the argument, obviously, that we did not have time to answer. We didn't have a motion filed by the plaintiffs for leave to amend. We didn't have time to perform discovery. We didn't even know the insurance policy or anything for this new party. So plaintiffs cited Rule 15A to give them the liberal ability to go ahead and amend their complaint.
Well, let me ask you this. If you had filed an interlocutory appeal right off of the denial of that motion to strike before the trial even started, we'd have to look at this case a little bit differently, because you can just look at what happened, what's the potential prejudice. The problem is, now that you've gone through the trial, whatever error happened in connection with that motion to strike now has to go through the filter of how it would have changed things at trial, or if it would have. You know, if you haven't had trial yet, the idea of, okay, what discovery can you get means one thing. If you've had the trial, now the idea is not only do you have to show that you could have gotten potential discovery, but it would have been admissible at trial, and it would have changed something at the trial. So, I guess really my question is, why didn't you file an interlocutory appeal at the time if it was such a big deal to you?
Well, at the time, Your Honor, the main issue was it was a new party and new causes of action. So we figured that there was no discovery at all. There was no evidence. There was nothing in the trial binders to even show that if this was a true complaint, that they would ever be able to prove the new causes of action at trial, which is something that Mr. Grant will be dealing with.
Why didn't you ask for a continuance of the trial?
Because if we had asked for a continuance really in that regard, because they had already granted this, the ability for them to file this complaint, gave the plaintiffs the time to go ahead and prove their case against us. So in this situation, they didn't have the evidence in which to prove any of the elements for subrogation. They didn't have the evidence to prove even indemnification at that point. So, we went forward with the trial. We didn't have an answer. We didn't have, all this was argued, obviously. Didn't have time to answer. We will file a motion to dismiss. We would have gone ahead and filed an answer and then gone into discovery.
Wouldn't your answer just basically have mirrored your, Silver Star did a fourth amended third-party complaint against you. Wouldn't it have just mirrored that?
No, because this is...
Because they stepped into the shoes of Silver Star at that point, the homeowners?
The main issue was the Claritin.
Is it what?
Was the insurance company actually coming into the case. Claritin. You're absolutely right. It would have mirrored the indemnification and Silver Star's.
Right, so what's the prejudice here? It's not like you added a new, it's not like they added a whole new subcontractor that you didn't know about. It's a subrogation claim, which means that the new party, yeah, to the extent they're a new party, they're stepping in the shoes of the old party. So what, since they're assuming whatever defenses and assuming whatever liabilities are there, what discovery prejudice actually accrued as opposed to just the hypothetical discovery that you think you might have tried to get?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. At this point, we didn't even have an insurance contract. We didn't know about the SIR, whether one even existed. We didn't know about payment. We didn't know who was responsible for payment. We didn't know if there's additional insured people paying part of the damages that Claritin was alleging. We had a lot of discovery in that regards. We had discovery in regards also to the other parties that Claritin may or may not be seeking, you know, reimbursement from. We didn't get to do any of that. So that there was a lot of discovery we could have done into the defense of the subrogation cause of action. So we weren't able to do that, and the reason was cited was 15A. You know, and the main thing the court focused on during that argument was you're allowed to go ahead and grant these motions because they are freely given most of the time. It was not looked into any of the prejudicial impact to my client. The prejudice impact was, you know, virtually ignored during this argument. If you look at the record, it wasn't even really discussed.
You indicated that discovery could have been done, but to Judge Silver, you said we didn't ask for a continuance, so a strategic choice was made?
In that situation, we didn't ask for a continuance, yes, Your Honor, because discovery wasn't done, they hadn't produced anything to prove these claims that they've now been brought at the last second. You know, the decision was just to go ahead and go on with the trial. Not to do another locker appeal. I think we always intended to appeal this judgment, not to go ahead and allow us to go forward with the claim as it was. The oral argument was very clear at that point. But the decision not to continue the trial, well, now all of a sudden I'm going to give them the ability to prove payment, to prove an insurance agreement, to prove everything that would have been required for the bulk of the damages.
How about looking back on it now and you say, all right, we could have done this discovery, that discovery. But when you look at what the jury really did, and the verdict compared to what the plaintiff was asking for, was there really any prejudice there? I mean, weren't the damages that the jury awarded the type that were already revealed during the previous discovery?
No. I think the jury was very confused, in especially when that goes to the verdict form. You know, the jury was very confused as to what they were supposed to do and what they weren't supposed to do, who the actual plaintiffs were, who the assignees were, what these parties are. I mean, going to the verdict form, you have one damages line, right? You have two parties, two causes of action, one damages line. We submitted our verdict form that had 10 questions and two damages lines. So really tried to separate those two. And instead we got stuck with a verdict form that had one damage line and a question regarding who was solely at fault.
Why didn't you put that proposed verdict form in your appendix?
Where is it?
Where is it?
I thought it was marked as an exhibit. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Unfortunately, it's not part of the record on appeal.
Okay. Then it's part of the record, I guess, in the case that it must not have been marked as the record on the appeal. I mean, the fact, in the briefs, I guess it's referenced that these things were done by both sides, that there was a special verdict, or at least a verdict form supplied by us. It was summarily rejected. Did have special interrogatories. I don't think that's at issue. I think the...
We don't know what they were.
Yeah, I mean, we don't... I don't know if it was admitted below or not, but we don't have a copy of it. Okay. I know what you say about it in the brief, but it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what's on there if you're just talking about it as opposed to letting us actually see it.
Okay. I think that the cases that we've cited actually go really into construction defect matters. These types of cases, multiple theories, and questions, multiple theories of damages also. I think in that point, Skender and the progeny of cases that were cited actually show that there should have been a special verdict form.
You want Mr. Grant to argue for a few minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferris.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lee Grant on behalf of Padilla Construction. The key point that I have to make today is first and foremost, the subrogation claims that plaintiffs were making at the time of trial on behalf of Claritin fail as a matter of law. I don't think that it's disputed the plaintiffs did not prove actual payment at the time of trial. That's the first and most basic element, and for that reason alone, any subrogation claim would fail, but it goes beyond that. Plaintiffs didn't, in fact, prove any subrogation elements. So the real question then became whether or not the indemnity causes of action assigned by Silver Star allowed plaintiffs to legally pursue the liabilities incurred by Clarendon. The answer is it did not. The rules set forth in Arguello and the reasoning behind it don't apply to this case because plaintiffs never proved that Silver Star suffered any damage attributable to Padilla that was not fully compensated. Did you have a question, Your Honor?
I'm sorry. I'm switching glasses. Sorry.
Accordingly, the indemnity claims against the indemnity claims assigned to plaintiffs by Silver Star, they didn't assign sufficient standing to make plaintiffs a real party in interest at that time to their liabilities incurred by Clarendon. And that's the key point, Your Honor, is going back in time to the time when this assignment was made. It was made in an agreement that actually eliminated any ongoing interest that Silver Star had in its indemnity claims. And again, that's the key point. You know, there's a lot of discussion in both briefs about Arguello and whether it applies and whether it doesn't apply. In Arguello, we have a plaintiff who has a whole world of rights. And part of those rights he was compensated for by his insurer, but he wanted damages above and beyond that, and he still had standing to pursue those. In this case, Silver Star was bringing indemnity claims against our client. And the purpose of that is to, as the Supreme Court has made clear in cases such as the Vincent case, it is to shift the liability that it was incurred by one party to the other that should have properly borne it. Again, this settlement agreement is unusual, and Your Honors have seen it, I'm sure, in the briefs and in the appendix. Clarendon comes in as almost a party to the agreement, and Clarendon assumes the obligation to pay the money. Clarendon assumes all of those liabilities. Silver Star didn't have those liabilities to assign to the plaintiffs via indemnification. So given that, the issue then is answered in the negative. The plaintiffs did not have standing. They were not in for the real party in interest ability pursuant to Arguello to allow it, and we believe that directed verdict should have been granted on the issue. I think I'm out of time.
Well, you can take part of the rebuttal time if you're not done.
I'll save my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right. All right. Thank you, Mr. Grant. Okay, so we have 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Good afternoon, Ms. Sagerboom. You were double teamed here. They covered an awful lot in 10 minutes. But you have 15 to respond to all of it and any additional points you want to make.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Eva Sagerboom on behalf of respondents. First of all, Your Honors, I think that this, from respondents' perspective, this really boils down to one issue, and that is whether appellant Padilla Construction Company of Nevada even has standing to challenge the subrogation issue, as well as the other issues that it's raised in the brief. And respondents would submit that they don't. If you boil this case down to really it's the most simple facts, what was actually presented to the jury, what the jury found, it's very simple. It's really just a straight contractual indemnity case. It's something I'm sure that all of Your Honors have seen in district court. It's something that goes on here all the time, and it's really just a general contractor suing their subcontractor for indemnification. You can throw out the assignment. You can throw out the language regarding subrogation. You could even throw out the Sixth Amendment complaint, and it wouldn't have changed what was needed to be shown at the trial, what was shown at the trial, what the jury was instructed on, and what the jury found. So I just don't want to get too far afield from the fact that it really is a simple case that they've tried to kind of cure and correct and complicate on appeal by raising several issues, one that I don't think were actually presented to the district court, but two, just trying to really muddy the issues. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have regarding the substantive law of subrogation, directed verdict standard, the jury verdict form, but I did want to make that clear that I think that under Arguello, they don't even have standing to challenge the subrogation issue.
Well, who decides that? There's not a lot of case law in subrogation in Nevada, but are you saying that subrogation is an issue that the district court has to determine separately before trial, or is it something that the jury determines?
I would say in this case, Your Honor, it wasn't even a separate cause of action. It's really just a basis to allow the assignees, the homeowners here, to proceed for the entire loss. Under Arguello, you have the Nevada Supreme Court saying that in the case of partial subrogation, either the insured or the insurer, they're both real parties in interest. And in the case of partial subrogation, you have the insurer can basically go after the tortfeasor for the entire loss. And so it's really a derivative of all these third-party complaints that Silver Star had filed 2 years ago against Padilla Construction Company of Nevada and that we had done discovery on for 2 years before trial. There was nothing new going into the trial.
What about the issue of the fact that the good faith settlement hadn't been ordered by the time until the end of trial?
I apologize, Your Honor. Could you repeat that?
What about the fact that the good faith settlement came after you already began trial?
Sure. You know, as to the good faith settlement, one, it was done on an order shortening time. It was done as soon as possible. They didn't even oppose it. They, you know, I think under Maynard v. Nault, the Nevada Supreme Court said failure to oppose a motion for good faith settlement or object in any way basically ratifies it. And so that's what we have here. I don't think that there really had to be a determination by the district court that the settlement was made in good faith in order for homeowners as assignees of Silver Star to proceed to trial, because you have a lot of Nevada case law that says, you know, you can bring a third-party complaint for indemnity and contribution before judgment, and that's really what we have here.
It's just an odd procedural move.
It's an odd procedural move. It's not.
Because hypothetically, what if the court had denied it after the trial, right?
If the court had denied it, I mean, yeah, there could have been much different. But you had really the only party that may have had a issue with it not even opposing it. So I don't think it would change where we are today. You know, getting back to...
What about Mr. Grant's point? He said there wasn't evidence of payment presented during the trial.
Well, I think we've cited a lot of cases regarding that one, there was a promise to pay. You know, there was an executed settlement agreement that was admitted at trial, authenticated at trial. So we had the promise to pay. Two, I would go back to my earlier point that there's a lot of Nevada case law that says you can bring a third-party complaint against a subcontractor for indemnity and contribution before there's a judgment. And then three, the payment was made before it went to the jury. So it's kind of I would say it's moot at this point because you had the promise to pay when the trial started. They didn't ask for a continuance. We proceeded to trial. The payment was made before it went to the jury.
Did the jury know that?
The jury did know that, I believe, Your Honor. But regardless, there was, you know, the testimony from the president of Silver Star, testimony from Silver Star's counsel that was retained by Clarendon. The settlement agreement was admitted at trial. The jury got to see the language of that settlement agreement. And going back to that motion for good faith, you know, the settlement agreement contained the assignment, again, which they never objected to. So I don't even know that as not being a party to the contract, they have standing to challenge the assignment. They really haven't made any clear arguments that they have challenged the assignment or that the assignment was not valid.
Do you remember what the objection was to the verdict form that was offered by Padilla?
Well, we tried to, again, respond to everything in our answering brief, and I think we distilled it into a discussion with the court about the verdict forms and that they wanted proximate cause added to the verdict form. And we said we don't think that that's necessary, but we did include proximate cause instruction as well as the elements of negligence. And I would say regarding the verdict forms, I think there would have been an issue and a problem with double recovery had we had both Clarendon and Silver Star on there. Because if you go back to it, we are talking about one set of operative facts, one theory of liability, and you don't want to have that broken down into separate sort of defendants that, or separate sort of plaintiffs, which wasn't really occurring here. You have, again, one theory of liability. We don't have alternate theories of liability. We don't have a comparative negligence. This isn't a typical construction defect case where you have homeowners going after a builder, builder bringing in tons of subs and all different trades and comparative negligence issues and potentially alternative theories of liability. And so that's really why we thought that the general verdict form was more correct in this case because we're really just asking for one finding. Was appellant negligent in the construction at these homes, and if so, in what amount? And it's, and that goes back to my point that it really, when you boil it down, it really is just a straight contractual indemnity when it's going to the jury.
How about if you go back to the beginning with the amended complaint? It seemed kind of unusual. That complaint was filed without a motion to the court. The court accepted it. There was no request for continuance, yet there was a complaint that more discovery was needed. So the Padilla didn't ask for a continuance, but did you offer a continuance or offer something so their discovery issues could at least be addressed to some degree?
Well, I think if you look at the record, Your Honor, one, I don't think that they've articulated any additional discovery that would have changed the contractual indemnity, which is, again, is what went to the jury, what the jury found, what the jury awarded on. I don't, you know, we really were stepping into the shoes of Silver Star. And
all of those documents you had provided already in discovery?
Yes, this has been a case going on for a long time.
Right.
Multiple parties, lots of discovery. I think there were close to 50 depositions in this case alone. I mean, way more than that.
It almost sounded like when they were arguing that they would have asked for more contracts that may have been out there. What was, I'm assuming that, and we don't get those exhibits, but I'm assuming that anything that was admitted at trial, that was produced in discovery.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And, you know, they obviously would have had their right to object to that at the time. But I can tell you that both subcontracts applying to Padilla were admitted at trial, as well as several other subcontracts, because they were trying to argue that their scope of work overlapped some other subcontractors, and so they wanted to have those subcontracts admitted at trial, and it all came in.
So those subcontractors' agreements came in, and obviously Padilla and Silver Stars came in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Along with, okay.
So there was...
Was there a scheduling rule in place that governed when the complaint could be amended? Was there a cutoff date for that?
There was a case management order, and I believe it had a date for amended complaints unless by, you know, leave of the court. And I would argue that despite there not being an actual motion for leave to the court, that
because here's what I'm going with that is there's actually two rules of civil procedure potentially at play. If, in fact, you amend the complaint, if you want leave to amend a complaint and you ask for that leave after the court's scheduling order imposes the deadline, now you have to deal not only with Rule 15A, but with Rule 16B, which is you have to show good cause why you're violating the court's discovery order. I didn't see anything in the briefing on this, and I didn't even see that there was a copy of the scheduling order, but what's your response to that?
I would say that, you know, it really, and I think this is what the court looked at, it didn't change anything. It didn't change anything that Silver Star previously had. You know, in hindsight, we probably didn't need to amend the complaint. You could throw out that sixth amended complaint because we're really just stepping into the shoes of Silver Star. We're not adding a new cause of action. We're not changing anything about the theories of liability at that point. But we wanted to make it clear, you know, that we did have this assignment, and that's really why we did the amended complaint. And I would say that it's probably really more akin to NRCP 25C, where it's a transfer of interest after the action is already ongoing, and that would give, you know, finality to all the parties, including Silver Star, who we, you know, transferred their interest to us. And it would also say that, you know, Silver Star doesn't have a right to later come after Padilla to any extent. So I would say it's probably more akin to NRCP 25C in the transfer of interest, and that really no new causes of action were raised. It didn't change anything. I mean, even if the Sixth Amendment complaint had been stricken, we still could have proceeded, and nothing changed from Silver Star's Fourth Amendment third-party complaint when you're looking at what was actually presented to the jury, what the jury found.
But when someone complains, back to my original question, oh, you're adding something new, we need discovery, but they don't ask for a continuance. Was there a response that, well, yeah, we don't really want to continue it either, but if there's any additional documents, we'll give them to you. Just tell us what you need. If there's a new witness, we'll make them available to you. That sort of response, so the trial schedule can stay on track.
And I think we tried, I mean, you can look, we had multiple days of discussion about the court with this before the trial began. I don't think it's really on the plaintiffs, it's the plaintiff's burden to ask for a continuance or to offer a continuance, because they really failed to articulate what other discovery do you need at that point. This case had been ongoing for a long time. Certainly if there was anything we could have helped with in terms of documents that hadn't already been produced, but in our minds, we had produced all the documents. Silver Star produced all the documents. I mean, we had, you know, 200-plus exhibits at trial. We were swimming in documents. And if there was a witness, certainly we would have, you know, bent over backwards to bring them to the trial. But again, we, as the plaintiffs at the time, we were trying to prove our case. And that's what we focused on, was proving appellant's negligence such that they had to indemnify Silver Star homeowners as assignees of Silver Star. And that's really all the trial was about. That's all that was, you know, went to the jury and what the jury was asked to find. So, you know, a few things. I think that appellant's counsel made some arguments about Arguello and that Arguello isn't applicable here, and I would just wholeheartedly disagree. Arguello is certainly the lay of the land when it comes to partial subrogation in Nevada. It's what the Nevada Supreme Court has, you know, very clearly laid out its findings on partial subrogation, and partial subrogation is absolutely what we had here. And going back to what I was in the middle of earlier, and when there is partial subrogation, either the insured or the insurer can proceed. If there's partial subrogation, the insurer can basically go after the tortfeasor for the entire loss. And what Arguello even went a step further and said is that if the insurer does go after that tortfeasor for that entire loss, the tortfeasor does not have standing to challenge the distribution of proceeds. So if the insurer goes after that tortfeasor, there is a recovery. The distribution of the recovery between insured and insurer is only a question between them. It's the appellant or the tortfeasor does not have standing to even challenge that distribution of proceeds. So I think that that absolutely is applicable here. I see that I'm about out of time.
Make a last comment.
I was just going to comment on the verdict forms, but I think I've covered that point sufficiently. Any other questions, Your Honors?
All right. Thank you, Ms. Segerblum.
Thank you very much.
All right. Did you want to switch who was going to make the final argument?
I believe so, Your Honor. If it may please the Court, I'll address the final points.
All right. So we have Mr. Grant.
How do you respond to counsel's argument that this is more akin to NRCP 25C, that this is just a transfer of interest? Didn't really the district court judge, after all the parties settle out, just make it simpler for the jury by focusing on the issue with Padilla and the stucco?
The problem we have, Your Honor, is it's not a transfer of interest. Well, there is a transfer of interest through the assignment, but the actual amendment of the complaint is not a transfer of interest. These are separate and distinct causes of action. Again, whether subrogation is or isn't a cause of action is debatable, but at the very least it has elements that must be met before it may be pursued. So I made the point earlier that at the time of the assignment, Silver Star had no further indemnity that it could seek. At most, that we've got questions of this SAR, whether it was incurred, whether it was actually paid, whether it's actually recoverable, and that goes to Arguello, which I'd hopefully talk about here in a moment. But the point is, at the most, what Silver Star could have recovered through indemnity, understanding that that's a separate cause of action that has its own measure of damages, is at most the $40,000 SAR. It had incurred at that point no other liability. Clarendon incurred other liability. Clarendon's a different party, and Clarendon, again, has its rights solely through subrogation. Now, subrogation does not allow the subrogee, if I've got the right terminology, it doesn't allow it to stand in the shoes of Silver Star completely. There was no negligence cause of action against Padilla at the time of trial. There was subrogation, and there was indemnity. Now, negligence has a role to play in indemnity, but negligence has a greater scope of damages. Indemnity or subrogation, you're limited. So in subrogation, the subrogated insurer is limited to the amount that it's actually paid. We've had discussions about whether discovery is necessary. It changes fundamentally the aspect of what we have here, because we have testimony at trial that additional insured obligations were still being collected. We have evidence of that in both of the briefs, that even after trial, even during appeal, people are still trying to collect on these additional insured obligations. Well, subrogation is an equitable ability, so you've got offsets to that. Whether additional insured obligations come in and are collected by Clarendon or by plaintiffs, whoever, it reduces the total overall value of what they can recover. There's a number of elements. The second element is whether or not the subrogee, i.e. Clarendon, acts as a volunteer. Again, an assigner cannot assign a greater right than what it has. Our Supreme Court has gone so far as to say in order to meet that second element, you need to interpret the insurance policy. I mean, Mr. Ferris indicated at the outset no insurance policy between Silver Star and Clarendon was provided. So what the judge did is, yes, he simplified these causes of action for the jury, but he oversimplified them. Causes of action that have distinct elements were blurred and muddled, and what we ended up with was a result that's not legally, that doesn't legally flow through the different channels available. You know, in Arguello, we keep coming back to Arguello, and Arguello is a different animal. The reason why is the plaintiff in Arguello had causes of action and ability to recover everything, both what he was reimbursed for by his insurer as well as what his other damages might have been. There was a loss of use of a vehicle. There was loss of upgrades that he wasn't compensated for by his insurer. What the plaintiffs received in this case wasn't carte blanche ability to sue for every possible damage. They're very discreet damages that each of these different causes of action allow them to have. So that's where the verdict form comes in. And one of the points Your Honors had asked is why our special or why our proposed verdict form wasn't in the record. And a point I would make to that isn't, you know, I would ask the court not to focus on the fact that it's not in the record, but look at the fact that it's unquestioned, it is in the record, that we proposed a verdict form. We have two causes of action, two separate and distinct theories of liability, both of which require separate proof. That's been conceded by plaintiff, I believe, in the brief.
But what you want us to do is you want us to say that the district court erred by not giving you a verdict form, and you have no idea what that verdict form actually looks like.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I think what is the key point here is that the verdict form that we did see is a verdict form that doesn't make sense. And I say that because we sit here today, the court, counsel, everybody else, do we know how much was awarded via plaintiff's assigned right for indemnity? We don't. Because plaintiff wasn't only assigned Silver Star's right to indemnity, but also was assigned the liabilities that come with that, whether there was offer of judgments, which were present in this case. We cannot determine whether those offers were beat based on what we have in a verdict form. So, I mean, at the very least, I think that, you know, the subrogation elements are very clear in all jurisdictions. Nobody cited anything to the contrary, and we believe that reversal is warranted here.
Do you want to take just a moment to say, to respond to Ms. Sagerboom's first argument? She says, no standing.
And I will, Your Honor. And I thank you for giving me the time to do so. They take the position that we have no standing because a motion for good faith was not opposed. Well, nobody on Padilla's side disputed that this settlement between plaintiffs and the various parties was committed fraudulently or in anything other than good faith. A motion for good faith has its own results, but those results don't somehow deprive the other party of the opportunity to question whether or not the opposing party has standing.
I think that she also said that you have no standing to object to the assignment.
Like, I understood, Your Honor.
Between the parties, where do you get standing?
She's saying, if I can hopefully reinterpret, is in Arguello it says that, you know, if the plaintiff recovers more than what they're what they were paid for by their insurance company, the question of how that's split between them is between those. It doesn't say they're standing or no standing. It says that if there's a recovery, that's between the insurer and the insured, if Arguello applies. But again, the issue here is we're not arguing how that should be split up. We're questioning whether the plaintiffs at the time had standing, whether their subrogated rights were ripe, and we say they did or not. It was abuse, we believe, to allow those claims in without discovery. I've mentioned some of those points. So I think the standing is maintained.
All right, Mr. Grant, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Ferris, thank you, too. Good job by both of you, and Ms. Segerblum, you, too. I got a feeling you only wanted to talk for a couple of minutes, and you ended up with 15 minutes. All right, but
I think your grandmother was one of my teachers, too, by the way, in Boulder City.
All right, this matter will be submitted to the court for a decision after further deliberation, and we'll hopefully have something out for you in the very near future.